A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hey, Herman and Corin. So we've done quite a lot of episodes lately about organization, home organization, labeling, and all the rest of it. As you know, my wife and I are moving in a couple of months, and I've been the last few days getting everything in, like, you know, meticulous order for the move while we view apartments, so that when we have a mover booked, I'm going to try do it as close as I can to how you mentioned that those who move every day do it, people like tour roadies and the US military. What a couple of examples. But we had a fascinating episode where you pointed out that they've essentially all converged on the same system, which makes even my slightly ludicrous degree of organization with my home inventory system and my boxes look like amateur hour. They have, you know, diagrams for literally everything. The hardest part of, or the part of the move that I'm really not looking forward to, is that since we took up residence in our current rental, soon to be former rental, I set up a home network. I don't like the term home lab, but I guess you could call it something like a home lab. Think Ethernet switches, servers, the rest of it. And I'm currently working on the networking cabinet, which is where stuff comes in. We have our ISP gateway that goes into my OpenSense box, that goes to then there's a switch, and then it goes out to the rest of the network. And I want to put this back together as easily as possible in the next place that we rent, which, if it's a place that has the same ISP and fiber, which is actually a very strong chance, I would say even a strong likelihood, then ideally, as I built the network very carefully, static IPs, the rest of it, I should be able to just get a new internet connection, get a new gateway, plug that into my OpenSense box, switch the rest of it. Now, you may be able to guess where I'm going with this. The tricky part, and I can't tell you how many hours have been wasted. In fact, it was one particularly failed troubleshooting bout in which I realized that when you've got, you know, 10 patch cables in a small enclosed space and you're trying to just look at them and figure out what's going on. Okay, the gateway is going into the OpenSense box, which is going into the switch, which is going out to this downlink thing. And that's where, although I understand it, it might seem extremely neurotic to want to do things like labeling cables. It probably would have saved me hours of time if I'd already done that. Now, here's the slightly tricky part. I'm down here in the networking cabinet, which is a repurposed IKEA box. I've got all my gear. I've got my paint markers, which can do very, very fine markings, given that a lot of tech stuff is black. Think black UPSs, black PDUs, black switches. I don't know. I guess it's the color that most of these plastic bodies are. So the white paint marker is a good one. And then I've got my label printer. But it's really, really frustrating to try to do this. I've tried, like, if you try to mark the Ethernet cables physically, right? So let's say I have two long-run Ethernet cables coming out of the router. One is feeding a server, one is downlink. So I've tried wrapping cables around them and even buying a specific type of cable, ribbon cable, that said it was, you know, it would stay in place wrapped around a cable, which any industrial label printer will print. It's never worked for me. I've tried to print those little cable flag thingies and they look really ugly. And they also kind of just stick to one another, come undone. They're not really good solutions. I saw one thing, and I'm not sure if this was my imagination or I thought that the product did something it didn't, but it was on AliExpress and it was depicting a networking rack where the cables were color coded. I'm not talking about the physical Ethernet cables themselves, but the ports had a little, what looked like a little LED light to give an indication so that, you know, you can write down, and this is what I'm planning on doing, port one on firewall, connect to port one on router, red cable or something like that. Now, I guess you could buy actual color-coded cables. I've just never seen a multicolor pack for sale. But anyway, I figured someone must have thought about this problem or been in this situation before. My end goal is to label it however can get the job done most effectively and cleanly, such that when I'm in my new place, I can just literally reconnect server to switch to gateway and get the network static IPs already set, and everything just comes back up. And I say, that was pretty cool. I'd love to do that again. I would love to never do that again, but it was as good as it could have been. Herman and Korn, what would be your recommendation if you're finding yourself managing a network, a business network, a home network? You're moving and you're going to have to set it all up from scratch somewhere else. All that tedium of putting down Ethernet cables and running them around the back of stuff, that we can't avoid. But how would you get the actual switches labeled and identified to make the job of putting everything back together as easy as possible?
There is a specific moment of despair that I think every person who runs their own network knows intimately. You're crouched in front of a repurposed IKEA cabinet. The door is digging into your shoulder, and you're staring at a fistful of identical black Ethernet cables, packed so tightly you can't trace any of them with your fingers, let alone your eyes. One of them is your WAN link. One of them goes to the server that hosts your entire media library. One of them is the downlink to the switch in the living room. And you have to disconnect all of them, move to a new apartment, and plug them all back in again, without spending 3 hours playing the world's most frustrating game of cable roulette.
The stakes are not trivial. If you get it wrong, your carefully configured pfSense box with its static IPs and VLANs and firewall rules just sits there blinking at you, and your spouse wants to know why the internet isn't working in the new place. And you have to say something like, I'm troubleshooting the layer 2 topology, which is not the answer anyone wants to hear on moving day.
It's the networking equivalent of defusing a bomb while someone asks if you've seen the box labeled kitchen scissors.
So the prompt asks what we'd recommend for someone managing a network, home or business, who's about to move and wants the reconnection to be as close to zero drama as possible. The core question is, how do you label and identify your switches and cables so that when you arrive at the new place, you can literally reconnect everything and have it all come back up?
The listener has already tried the obvious solutions. Paint markers on black equipment chassis, which works for labeling the gear itself, but not the cables. Those little flag labels that wrap around Ethernet cables, and then immediately unstick themselves and cling to each other like they're in a support group. Ribbon cable labels that promised they'd stay put, and didn't. The whole consumer-grade labeling ecosystem has failed, and the question is, what actually works?
Before we get into the specifics, and we're going to get very specific, I want to name the real problem here, because it's not what most people think it is. The problem isn't that the labels fall off. That's a symptom. The problem is that most people are trying to label the wrong thing in the wrong way, and they're doing it without a system that exists independently of the physical cables. So let me ask you this. What does a label actually do when you stick it on a cable? It says, this cable goes to the server, or this is the WAN link. That information lives on the cable itself. So when you unplug everything and coil it up and shove it in a box, the label is still there, but the context is gone. You're standing in the new apartment holding a cable that says server B, and you have no idea which port it was plugged into, which switch it came from, or whether it was the primary link or the failover. The label answered the wrong question.
It's like writing someone's name on their coffee cup, but not writing down where they sit. The cup is labeled. The coffee gets delivered to the wrong desk anyway.
That's exactly the analogy. And this is where paint markers fail, flag labels fail, ribbon cable fails. They're all trying to solve the problem of, how do I mark this physical object? When the real problem is, how do I preserve the relationship between this cable and everything it touches?
The cable is just the middleman. It's not where the information lives. It's what the information flows through.
So let's talk about why each of these consumer solutions breaks in practice, because the failure modes are instructive. Paint markers, white paint marker on a black Ethernet jacket. It works for about a week, and then the jacket flexes, the paint micro cracks, and you're left with a smudge that might say WAN, or might say wax, or might just be an abstract expressionist piece in your cable management.
I'd pay good money for a cable labeled wax.
The flag labels. Those little wraparound things that come out of a Brother or Dymo label maker. The problem is surface energy. Ethernet cable jackets are typically PVC or low-smoke zero-halogen material, and both have low surface energy. Adhesives don't bond well to low-energy surfaces. Add heat cycling inside a closed cabinet, which can easily hit 40 degrees Celsius with equipment running, and the adhesive creeps. The flag label curls, it catches on adjacent cables, it peels off entirely. The ribbon cable labels have the same adhesion problem, plus they add bulk to the cable, which makes cable management worse, not better.
Colored electrical tape, the beginner's trap.
Colored electrical tape is the worst of all, because it leaves residue, the adhesive dries out, and the tape unwinds itself, and after 6 months in a warm cabinet, it's basically just a sticky ghost of good intentions.
Every obvious solution is trying to make the cable carry its own identity, and the cable is fundamentally hostile to being labeled. It's cylindrical. It's made of material that repels adhesives, it flexes, it gets hot, it rubs against other cables. The cable doesn't want your label.
Which brings us to the core insight, and this is where the military and touring roadies have already solved the problem in a way the consumer networking world hasn't caught up to. They don't try to make the cable tell you where it goes. They give the cable a short, unique identifier, something like A01 or CBL-003, and then they put the actual relationship information somewhere else. A patch map. A cable schedule. A document that lives outside the rack.
The cable gets a license plate, not a biography.
That's it. That's the entire paradigm shift in 6 words. The license plate tells you nothing by itself. You need the DMV database to know who owns the car. But the license plate is short, durable, and universally understood. The patch map is the DMV database for your network.
The roadies have been doing this for decades. You walk up to a touring rack. Every XLR cable has a tiny piece of white gaff tape with a code on it, and inside the rack lid, there's a laminated sheet that maps every code to its source and destination. They don't label the cable with lead vocal mic to channel 7. They label it V01, and the sheet tells you what V01 means.
The U.S. Army has a formal standard for this, MIL-STD-681, the Cable and Harness Standard. It mandates unique alphanumeric identifiers on every cable assembly, with a corresponding wiring diagram stored in the equipment's technical manual. They arrived at this not because it's elegant, but because when you're reassembling communications gear in a field environment, you cannot afford to guess which cable goes where.
Neither can you afford to guess when your spouse is asking why the internet isn't working, and you're sweating into an IKEA cabinet.
Here's the promise of this episode. By the time we're done, you'll have a concrete, step-by-step plan for documenting your current network, the one that's still plugged in and working right now, so that when you arrive at the new place, the reconnection takes under 30 minutes. Not 3 hours of tracing cables and squinting at smudged paint marker. 30 minutes of methodically plugging things in, checking boxes on a sheet, and having everything come back up the first time.
The goal is to do the thinking once now while the network is intact and you can see how everything connects. Capture that knowledge. Make it durable. Then the move itself is just mechanical reassembly.
The first step, the thing that separates this approach from every failed labeling attempt, is understanding what you're actually documenting. You're not labeling a cable. You're documenting a connection. A connection has a source port, a destination port, a purpose, and a logical identity. The cable is just the physical instantiation of that connection. The documentation lives independently of the cable, which means it survives the cable being unplugged, coiled, transported, and replugged somewhere else entirely. That independence is crucial, because it leads directly into why your physical labels keep failing. Let's talk about the material science behind that failure, because once you understand the physics, you stop blaming yourself and start blaming the adhesive industry.
Which is a much healthier target for resentment.
Ethernet cable jackets are almost always PVC or low-smoke zero-halogen compound. Both have what's called low surface energy. Think of surface energy as how welcoming a material is to adhesives. High surface energy, like metal or glass. Adhesives grab on and hold. Low surface energy, Like polyethylene, polypropylene, PVC, the adhesive just kind of sits there, waiting for an excuse to leave.
Like a guest at a party who's already checked their watch twice.
Then you put that cable inside a closed cabinet with a switch and a router churning out heat, and the temperature cycles between ambient and maybe 45 degrees Celsius. That thermal cycling causes what adhesive engineers call creep. The adhesive literally flows microscopically, losing its bond over time. The flag label that looked great on day one is curled and peeling by day 30.
The cable is chemically unwelcoming and thermally unstable. It's a hostile work environment for glue.
That's before we even get to the geometry problem. Cables are cylindrical. A flat label on a curved surface means the edges are under constant tension, trying to lift. The smaller the cable diameter, the worse the problem. Cat 6 cable is about 6 millimeters thick. That's a pretty aggressive curve for a flat adhesive label to conform to.
Which is why those wraparound flag labels seem clever in theory. You print them, you wrap them around the cable, the ends stick to each other, but now you've got adhesive bonding to itself, not to the cable jacket, and the whole assembly just slides along the cable like a ring on a finger.
If you've ever tried to pull a cable through a bundle with flag labels on it, you know exactly what happens. The flags catch on adjacent cables. They fold, they tear, they come off entirely. The label becomes a liability.
This is the point in the episode where I'd like to acknowledge that everything the listener has tried and found wanting was designed to fail. It's not incompetence. It's physics.
Which brings us to the solution that actually works, and it's been hiding in plain sight in the industrial world for years. Heat shrink tube labels.
Ah, the label that becomes one with the cable.
You print the label onto a heat shrink tube. Both Brother and Epson make cartridges specifically for this, the Brother P-Touch HSC series or the Epson LabelWorks heat shrink tubes. You slide the tube onto the cable, apply heat, a heat gun or even a decent hairdryer at about 125 degrees Celsius, and the tube shrinks at a 2-to-1 or 3-to-1 ratio, forming a permanent mechanical bond around the cable jacket.
It's not relying on adhesive at all, is it?
There is a thin adhesive lining that activates with heat, but the primary holding force is the compression of the tube itself. It physically cannot peel off. It cannot slide. It cannot curl. You'd have to cut it off with a knife.
It solves the surface energy problem, the thermal cycling problem, and the geometry problem all at once. That's almost elegant.
The print quality on these things is surprisingly good. You can fit a short alphanumeric code, say 6 to 8 characters, on a tube segment that's maybe 2 centimeters long, and it's crisp, heat-fused onto the material. It won't smudge, it won't fade, it won't rub off. This is what data centers use. This is what industrial control panels use. It's just that nobody told the home networking community.
We're telling them now.
The only catch is you need a label maker that supports the heat-shrink tube cartridges. The Brother P-Touch models that take the HSC tube start around $60 or $70. The tubes themselves are maybe $15 to $20 for a cartridge that'll do dozens of cables. It's not free, but it's also not expensive compared to the cost of spending 3 hours troubleshooting a network that should have taken 20 minutes to reconnect.
Compared to the emotional cost of crouching in an IKEA cabinet at 11 p.m., wondering which black cable is which.
That cost is unquantifiable.
We've solved the physical labeling problem. Heat shrink tube, short code, done. But now we need to talk about what goes on the label, and this is where the system part comes in.
The instinct, and I've done this, I think everyone who's ever labeled a cable has done this, is to put the destination on the label. Living room switch. And that seems helpful in the moment because you're standing there looking at the cable and you want to know where it goes.
The moment you unplug it, living room switch doesn't tell you which port on the living room switch or which switch it came from up here, or whether it's the primary or backup link.
If you ever repurpose the cable, if server B becomes the new NASS, now the label is lying to you. You either live with the wrong label or you peel off the heat shrink tube you so carefully installed.
The label becomes technical debt.
That's exactly what it becomes. So the system that the military uses, that touring roadies use, that data center operators use, is to label the cable with a unique identifier that means nothing by itself. A license plate. CBL-001, A03, NET-12, something short, unique, and meaningless without the map.
The map is the thing that tells you what CBL-001 actually connects.
This is the patch map. A patch map is fundamentally a table. It doesn't need to be complicated. The columns are cable ID, source device, source port, destination device, destination port, and purpose. That's it. You can build this in a spreadsheet, in a note-taking app, on a piece of paper taped to the inside of the cabinet door. The format matters less than the fact that it exists somewhere other than on the cable itself.
Let's make this concrete. I'm in my networking cabinet right now. Everything is plugged in and working. What's my first move?
You open a spreadsheet and you start at one end of the chain. The ISP gateway, where does it go? It goes to the FSense WAN port, so row 1, cable ID, you assign it, call it W01. Source device is ISP gateway, source port is port 1. Destination device is FSense, destination port is WAN. Purpose is WAN uplink, then you move to the next cable. PFSense, LAN port goes to switch port 1, cable ID L01.
You just work your way through the entire cabinet, cable by cable, building rows in the spreadsheet.
And this is the key. You do this before you touch a single cable. You do it while everything is connected and working, because that's when you can actually see and verify what goes where. You're not guessing. You're documenting reality.
This is the psychological shift. Instead of labeling as a thing you do during the move, labeling becomes a thing you do before the move, while the network is still intact and you have all the context.
Once the map is built, then you label the cables. Each cable gets its cable ID printed on a heat shrink tube, applied about 2 or 3 inches from the connector on both ends. Both ends get the same ID, because when you're holding the switch end of a cable, you need to know which cable it is without tracing it all the way back to the server.
Then you take photos, multiple angles of the cabinet with the cables visible and the ports visible. These photos are your fallback. If the patch map gets lost in the move, and things get lost in moves, you have visual reference of what went where.
Store the photos in a cloud folder. Call it something obvious, like,
we've got the patch map built and the cables labeled. Now let's talk about the thing the listener is actually worried about. He's got this carefully constructed logical network, VLANs, DHCP reservations, firewall rules, and the question is whether the physical labeling system actually helps him reconnect the logical layer, or if he's still going to be SSHing into the FSense box at midnight, trying to remember which interface was which.
The good news is, static IPs are already documentation. They encode the topology. The listener's FSense box knows that VLAN 10 lives on a specific interface and that interface expects a certain subnet. The challenge isn't rebuilding the logical network. That's stored in the config. The challenge is mapping physical cables to those logical interfaces so the config actually works when you plug things in.
Which is where the patch map earns its keep. You add two columns, IP address and VLAN ID. So now a row reads, cable ID W01, source ISP gateway port 1, destination PFSense, WAN port, IP 192.168.1.1/24, VLAN untagged, purpose WAN uplink.
Suddenly, the map isn't just telling you what plugs into what. It's telling you what the network should look like when it's working. It becomes a verification tool. When you reconnect at the new place, you ping each static IP from a laptop and check it off the map. If something doesn't respond, you know exactly which cable to trace.
Let's address the AliExpress product the listener mentioned, the LED lit ports. That's a real thing. Panduit and Simon make intelligent patch panels with LED guidance. Panduit's smart zone system came out around 2019, and a 48-port unit runs about $800. The management software lights up the specific port you need to connect, so you literally can't plug into the wrong one.
Which is brilliant for a data center with hundreds of ports and junior technicians doing moves at 2 a.m. For a home networking cabinet with maybe 12 to 20 connections total, it's like using a flamethrower to light a candle. $800 to solve a problem that a $20 pack of colored heat shrink tubing solves just as well.
The colored heat shrink on the RJ45 boots. That's the budget version of the LED panel.
Cable Matters and Monoprice both sell multicolor packs of RJ45 boots or heat shrink tubing, 10 colors for around $15 to $20. You assign a color to each VLAN or device type. red for WAN, blue for the main LAN, green for IoT, yellow for management. Then when you're reconnecting, you don't even need to read the label to know that all the green cables go to the IoT switch ports. The color tells you at a glance.
Which also means if you drop the patch map behind the cabinet during the move, you still have a coarse visual grouping that'll get you 80% of the way there.
Here's the thing about the ISP gateway swap that the listener is counting on. He said there's a strong chance the new place has the same ISP and fiber. If that's true, the pfSense WAN config probably works without changes. Plug in the new gateway, pfSense gets a DHCP address or uses the same static config, and everything comes up.
If the new place has a different ISP, say he moves from somewhere with Comcast to somewhere with AT&T fiber, there's a real chance the WAN configuration changes. AT&T fiber often requires VLAN tagging on the WAN port, VLAN 201 specifically, where Comcast typically uses untagged traffic.
I've seen exactly this. Someone moved from a Comcast house to an AT&T fiber apartment, and suddenly their pfSense box couldn't get a WAN address. Nothing was broken. The WAN port just needed VLAN 201 tagged on it. Because they had a patch map that showed exactly which cable went to the pfSense WAN port and what its current config was, they updated the VLAN tag in pfSense, noted the change on the map, and were back online in 5 minutes.
5 minutes versus the alternative, which is 45 minutes of forum posts and trial and error.
The map doesn't just survive the move. It gets better after the move because you update it with the new reality.
Let's walk the actual reconnection workflow, step by step, because this is where the system pays off. You're at the old place. Everything is still plugged in. Before you touch a single cable, you have your patch map printed out, your photos taken, and your heat shrink labels already applied from the documentation phase.
Step 1. Disconnect everything, but do it methodically. Unplug one cable, coil it with a Velcro tie, and make sure the cable ID label is visible on the outside of the coil. Don't just throw cables in a box. If you coil them neatly with the label showing, you save yourself the later step of uncoiling 17 cables to find the one you need.
Step 2. At the new place, lay out your equipment in roughly the same physical orientation as before. pfSense on top, switch below it, patch panel if you have one. You don't need the same IKEA cabinet, but keeping the devices in the same vertical order means the cable lengths still work and the mental model transfers.
Step 3. Use the patch map to reconnect one cable at a time. Start from the top of the map, usually the WAN connection, and work down. Check off each row as you go. This is deeply satisfying in a way that's hard to explain to people who don't maintain networks.
It's the satisfaction of a checklist where every item is a small victory.
Step 4. Power everything on in order. ISP gateway first, let it sync. Then pfSense, let it boot. Then switches, then servers. And step 5, ping each static IP from your laptop. If everything responds, you're done. If something doesn't, the patch map tells you exactly which cable to check.
One bonus tip that's easy to overlook. Take a photo of the physical layout of the cabinet itself with a ruler for scale. When you're buying a new cabinet or shelf for the new place, you'll know exactly how much depth you need, where the ventilation gaps are, and whether the gear will actually fit before you drill anything.
That's the kind of thing that sounds obsessive until you're standing in IKEA trying to remember if your switch is 30 centimeters deep or 40, and the difference determines whether the cabinet door closes.
The patch map system works even if the physical layout changes completely. New cabinet, different wall, different room, it doesn't matter. The map describes connections, not positions. As long as the cables reach, you reconnect by following the rows, and the network behaves exactly as it did before.
What does that look like in practice, step by step, starting tonight? Let's boil it down to 4 things you can actually do right now before the move.
Before you touch a single cable, create the patch map. Spreadsheet, 7 columns. Cable ID, source device, source port, destination device, destination port, IP, address, /VLAN, purpose. Keep it with the equipment. This is the master document.
Heat shrink tube labels. Not flag labels, not ribbon labels, not paint markers. Heat shrink tubes with a 2-to-1 or 3-to-1 shrink ratio. They form a mechanical bond around the jacket. They don't rely on adhesive chemistry that fails when the cabinet hits 45 degrees Celsius. Print the cable ID on both ends of every cable 2 inches from the connector. Pair them with colored heat shrink boots for visual grouping. 10 colors, $15, done.
Multiple angles, good lighting, ports and labels visible. Store them in a cloud folder named Network Move and the date. These are your insurance policy. If the printed map gets lost or coffee gets spilled on it mid-move, the photos are your fallback.
Number 4, and this is the one people skip. Test the system before the move. Disconnect one cable. Then try to reconnect it using only the map. No memory, no tracing, no guessing. If the map gets you there in under 30 seconds, it works. If it doesn't, refine it. Better to find the gap while the network is still running than at midnight in the new apartment with your spouse asking why the Wi-Fi is down.
The test exposes what you thought was obvious but wasn't written down. So that covers the move itself.
Right. But the system works for a one-to-one move. Same gear, same cables, same layout. But what happens when the new place has different wall jacks, or the cable runs need to be longer, or you're adding a new switch because the new apartment has Ethernet drops in 3 rooms instead of 1?
The batch map scales. You don't need a new system, you just update the destination port column. The old row said cable ID L03 went from switch A port 5 to wall jack living room. The new row says switch port 5 to wall jack bedroom 2. The cable ID stays the same. The logic stays the same. Only the endpoint changes.
That's the thing about decoupling the identifier from the role. The label on the cable doesn't say living room, so when it stops going to the living room, you don't have to relabel it. You update the map and move on. This is the difference between a system that survives one move and a system that survives 20.
Which brings up the longer arc here. Home networks are not getting simpler. 5 years ago, most people had a router and maybe a switch. Now we've got IoT VLANs, guest networks, 10 gigabit backbones, multiple access points, PoE cameras, and whatever the next thing is that needs an Ethernet drop.
The documentation burden scales with the complexity. The patch map we described today, 7 columns in a spreadsheet, that's the foundation. But once you've got it, you can start treating your network more like code. Tools like NetBox let you define your entire network topology in a structured format. Devices, interfaces, cables, IP addresses, VLANs, and generate documentation from that. The patch map becomes a view, not a document you maintain by hand.
You could eventually generate it directly from your pfSense config. Parse the interface assignments, pull the static DHCP mappings, cross-reference with the switch port descriptions. The map writes itself.
For most home users, that's aspirational. But the key insight is that the spreadsheet is already a primitive database. Every column is a field. Every row is a record. You've already done the hard part, which is modeling your network as structured data instead of as a tangle of cables you kind of remember.
The goal isn't to never have cable management frustration again. That's not realistic. Cables are still cables. They still snag on things and get tangled in boxes and somehow multiply when you're not looking.
The goal is to make the frustration predictable. You know that reconnecting will take 40 minutes, not 4 hours, because you've got the map and the labels and the photos. And if something goes wrong, you know exactly where to look.
Solvable in under an hour. That's the standard. Not zero frustration. Bounded, predictable, fixable frustration.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
Contrary to popular belief, mantis shrimp do not have the world's most complex color vision. The original 2014 study that claimed they could see 12 to 16 color receptor types actually found they're worse at discriminating between similar colors than humans. Their eyes process each color channel independently with very little comparison between them, which means they see a riot of raw color data but can't distinguish subtle gradients the way a human can. The pop science narrative that mantis shrimp live in a psychedelic rainbow world was mostly a misreading of the paper.
Right. The shrimp sees everything and nothing at the same time. There's probably a metaphor in there about cable management, but I'm not going to make it.
Before we go, if this episode saved you from a moving day meltdown, or if you've got your own labeling war stories, we'd love to hear about it. Leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. It genuinely helps other people find the show.
This has been My Weird Prompts, produced by Hilbert Flumingtop. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. We'll be back with another one soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird promise, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.